A multi-track, multi-layered harmonies there, a masterpiece from the Beatles, Because is the song. We're talking with Scott Creighton about his new book, The Great Pyramid Hoax, which is going to cause a lot of ripples in Egyptological circles. When we come back, I'm going to ask Scott about the diaries of this British colonel, the guy who made the discovery, and what kind of evidence and paper trail he found in those diaries to shed light on the discovery that was made by the colonel. And then we'll be opening up the phone lines with your calls and questions and comments. I'm sure a lot of you have some thoughts on this topic. We'll be right back with more Coast to Coast AM. Scott Creighton, you had a colleague, a late colleague, Alan Alford. You mentioned him in the book that he had said at one point, my challenge to Egyptologists is this, find the Howard Weiss diaries and show them to me. If I can't find at least three incriminating statements in those diaries, I'll drop my argument that the workman's graffiti was forged. He was unable to access the diaries, but you did, right?
That's right, George. obviously, we know that there were original diaries because Howard Weiss's published accounts are basically set out as a diary. He published three volumes, and they're basically written in the form of a diary based on his original field notes, his original journals when he was at Giza. So we knew they existed. I'd kind of half-heartedly searched for these private diaries a number of times, but without much success over the years. Eventually, though, after a couple of false leads, and with the wonder of the internet, the wonder that is the internet, I finally managed to locate their whereabouts in a small archive centre in a little town called Aylesbury in to the north of London. And my goodness, George, when my wife Louise and I finally went to look at them in this small centre, what we found in those handwritten pages, you know, it was a lot more than either of us had ever bargained for, and it certainly justifies Alan Alford's comments.
You wrote in the book, I think, as far as you know, no one had ever looked at them.
Well, they're certainly now available in the public domain within this small archive centre. Anyone can go and look at them. They're there, you know. But
I'm trying to remember in the book whether you described how they were wrapped, that it looked as if they still looked like they were when they were handed over by the colonel.
Well, that's right. The colonel's estate, I think the library got them in the mid-1950s, something like that.
Oh, okay.
And they basically just lay in a vault all that time, wrapped basically in a very plain cream folder bound with some pieces of white linen. And when, you know, I opened the linen and opened the folder, there was all 600 pages, George, 600 pages of handwritten notes. And I have to say, Colonel Weiss didn't make it easy for us because his handwriting is absolutely execrable. It's appallingly bad and very, very difficult to read. But fortunately, because, as I said just a few moments ago, because his book was based on his published work, was based on his diary, obviously very easy to read, you can cross-reference the published book with you know, his handwritten notes, and you can kind of, you know, work out what certain words are, which may not be clear in his handwritten notes. So that's basically the background to how I managed to find them. And as I said, what I did find was pretty eye-opening.
Well, let's walk through it. What did you find that confirmed your suspicions that he had hoaxed this thing? I mean, one thing you found was that he wrote something that basically said, boy, it sure would be kind of great if I found something like this.
Well, but he says that, actually, George, in his published book. He tells us in his published book that he wanted to find the original burial place, the mummy, the sarcophagus of Khufu. He believed it would be found in one of these chambers that he was opening up, and it wasn't. Another thing he says, that failing that, he wanted to find a cartouche that would help to date the pyramid. And he writes that quite clearly in his published accounts. And so when you go through his private notes, what you begin to see are actually contradictory statements between one and the other. For example, in the first chamber that Weiss blasted his way into above Davison's chamber, as I said, Davison's chamber, as I said earlier, was opened 70 years before Weiss arrived on the scene, and nothing was found in it, not a single mark. The one above that, which Weiss called Wellington's chamber, after the British hero of the Napoleonic Wars, Weiss entered that chamber, and in his private notes, what he writes is this. There were some painted marks on the wall near the entrance. That's the east wall, but nothing like hieroglyphics. Now, when Weiss uses the term hieroglyphics, he's referring to these crudely painted gang names that he would have seen elsewhere in and around Giza. There's a whole load of them on the outside walls of Menkaure's temple at Giza, so he would have seen these all over the place. And he's basically saying there was nothing, he found nothing in those chambers that looked like hieroglyphics. There were some marks, and if you look at the marks that he talks about, they're very weird. They don't look like Egyptian writing. It's like a kind of half oval shape with geometric shapes within it. It just doesn't look Egyptian. So this is what Weiss is saying. He said he found some red marks, but nothing like hieroglyphics. That's in his private notes. I think it's the end of March 1837. Now, when you go to his published account of the very same day, or very same night, he'd already been in this chamber two times, George, by this time. And he'd been in on each occasion with a couple of his assistants. Now, in his published work, he then writes, and on this night, we found the quarry marks. So in his private diary, he's saying he found nothing, and in his published account, he's saying he found quarry marks. So there's his first contradiction right away. Now, the thing to remember here as well is that he tells us he was pretty keen, or desperate almost, to find a cartouche that would help to date the pyramid. And lo and behold, his assistant, Mr. Hill, if you go to the British Museum, Mr. Hill did what are called facsimile copies, one-to-one copies of the marks that they allegedly found in these chambers. And lo and behold, Mr. Hill had drawn a cartouche from Wellington's chamber. This is the very chamber that, Weiss tells us he found nothing in. And why would he say he found nothing in when there was a cartouche there, the very thing he was looking for? And then all of a sudden it appears. It's just a major, major contradiction. On the one hand, he's saying he found nothing. This is in his private journal. And then all of a sudden something appears. And in his published book, which he wrote 3 years later, he says, and on this night we found the quarry marks. So that's the first big clue that there's something unseemly going on here. But the other thing as well, George, is these marks that he says, they were strange marks. They don't look like Egyptian symbols at all. He couldn't identify them. And even to this day, no one can. There are other marks in the Great Pyramid that are strange to us and don't look like ancient Egyptian marks. And these marks, what I'm saying is that these marks that were in Wellington's chamber, they're obviously authentic because Weiss writes in his journal about them. That there's no reason, to lie about these particular marks that don't look like hieroglyphics. He's got no reason to lie about these. So they were there. They're original. In the small shaft cavity, there's a small cavity at the top of the southern star shaft of the Queen's Chamber of the Great Pyramid. And in this tiny, tiny cavity at the end of this chamber, in 2011, a robot went up this shaft, put a small endoscopic camera through a hole in the a blocking stone, and what this camera found when it panned around, it found some marks, painted marks, red painted marks on the floor of this tiny chamber. There was three distinct marks. And to this day, Egyptologists struggle to identify what these marks are. They think they may be numbers, Egyptian numbers, but they're absolutely not sure. But in my opinion, they can't be numbers because two of the numbers are the number 1 and the number 20. Now, if you go directly along at the very same level of the pyramid as this shaft cavity is, you go along a bit to the right, you're in Campbell's chamber. And in that chamber, we found the numbers 1 and 20 written in a completely different script. A completely different script from what Egyptologists believe in the numbers 1 and 20, or might be the numbers 1 and 20 in this small shaft cavity.
So you think the colonel and his two assistants busted into that thing and created these in order to have this world shattering discovery and become famous and set?
Well, the motives basically for perpetrating a fraud, Rice's motives for doing this within the Great Pyramid, it's a much more complex question, and to be honest, we'll probably never know for certain exactly what it was, George, that compelled him to commit this fraud. He certainly didn't need the money, as Rice was a very wealthy man in his own right, spending, I think in today's term, would be somewhere in the order of about $1.3 million during his operations at Giza. So I suppose it's fair to say that's a lot of money, and you have to say it's a lot of incentive.
Fame? Yeah, it's incentive to go ahead and find something.
Yes, yes. What I think we also have to keep in mind is the context of Rice's time. In 1837, Egypt's past was only just beginning to be rediscovered. Explorers, more accurately, treasure hunters from countries including Italy, France, and Germany, they were all making significant discoveries all over Egypt. But Weiss, you know, he was finding very little of real importance. And significantly, as I said just a few moments ago, he tells us on numerous occasions throughout his published work that he desired to make an important discovery, such as finding the burial chamber of the king, but more significantly, a cartouche of an Egyptian king that would help him to date the pyramid. So, you know, throughout his published work, we can detect a kind of growing sense of urgency in Weiss that is continuing failure to make an important discovery at Giza. It wouldn't have been good for him personally, nor indeed probably for British national pride and prestige. So that's another possible motive. But I think probably the main motive centered around Weiss's religious beliefs. He basically wanted to date the pyramid. He tells us this. He wants a cartouche to date the pyramid. The one thing he didn't want was for the Great Pyramid to be found to be older than the date of creation, which in Weiss's time was 4004 BC, something like that. And that's what they believed.
In the book, you follow up on the two assistants too, and you find some indications that they or their families knew that some funny business was underway.
Mr. Hill, one of Weiss's assistants, I think was complicit with Weiss in doing this forgery, and also a Mr. Raven. And we know this because of an eyewitness to this particular forgery. This was a chap called Humphreys Brewer, who worked with Weiss in 1837. He kind of ended up in Egypt at that time by accident. He was there for other purposes to help in build a medical center. That project fell through, and he ended up working with Weiss. And what we know from that story that has come down to is that he witnessed Hill and Raven painting over some faint marks inside these chambers and painting new marks inside these chambers. You know, so that's why I think, Hill and Raven, they were complicit along with Weiss in creating this forgery.
Scott, isn't there other kinds of evidence that have been used to establish the age, the DNA or carbon dating evidence of the boats that were found outside the pyramid.
Yeah, well, the thing is, George, I consider things like the boats and stuff like that possibly could have come from a much later culture that basically usurped Giza and took it as their own. Giza probably was already ancient in the time of this later culture. So I think, from my perspective, I'm looking at things inside the pyramid that can be carbon dated or, science applied to these particular marks. We touched on earlier the radiocarbon dating of the ochre sample that the German graduates took to be analysed in Germany. And what I should have also said at that point was that although they couldn't radiocarbon date that particular sample, the chemical analysis of the sample did provide additional information and good evidence that these marks were indeed faked by Colonel Weiss and his team in 1837. That's all I'd say. It's kind of difficult, George, to kind of try and look at the radiocarbon stuff of things outside the pyramid because even they did some analysis of charcoal. Samples of charcoal, which they found between the blocks and the mortar, between the blocks of the outer stones, the core blocks of the pyramid, and the radiocarbon dated those, and the date range for those go about between 400 years, roughly either way, of when the pyramid was built. But we don't know the provenance of these particular pieces of charcoal. Or carbon samples that they took, because as far as I'm concerned, the Great Pyramid could have been repaired by Khufu in the 4th dynasty, and that is how these pieces of charcoal got to be there. In fact, there's a stela known as the Inventory Stela, which tells us this very thing, that Khufu repaired monuments at Giza, including the Sphinx, which, seem quite strange because the Sphinx was supposedly built by Khufu's son. So how could Khufu be repairing something that his son had not yet actually built? We also have evidence on the Sphinx that from the Inventory Stela that tells us that there was the head of the Sphinx had been damaged and it was repaired by Khufu in ancient times. And sure enough, when you look, there's a repair exactly like the one that's described in this Inventory Stela. So we know what the Inventory Stela tells us is true. So when it tells us that Khufu repaired these monuments at Giza, including the Sphinx, Khufu could very well have been repairing the Great Pyramid as well. And that's why we have these radiocarbon particles stuck inside some of the blocks. Or these particles could even have been wind-blown. There's a lot of wind around the Giza Plateau, a piece of charcoal from, an ancient fire could have blown, up into these blocks. So the radiocarbon dating issue is a really tricky one because you're basically extrapolating a date and applying it to a structure when they may be completely unconnected.
Yeah, I guess it would make sense that there is carbon dating that shows that there was activity out there during the time of Khufu, because Khufu was a real person and he was there. We're going to continue our conversation with Scott Creighton about the Great Pyramid hoax after this, and we'll go to the phone lines with your questions and comments. Because the Night takes us into the break. One last song with Because in the title, this one from Dave Clark 5. That's a really pretty song. We're talking with Scott Creighton about his book, The Great Pyramid Hoax. In a moment, we go to the phones with your questions, calls, and comments. We'll be right back. We go to the phones. First-time caller, Ray in Greeley, Colorado. Hi, Ray. You're on with Scott Creighton.
Hi, George. Hi, Scott. Hey, before we go on, I want to ask you a question. Now, the Great Pyramid Hoax, are you saying that it is the hoax that the pyramids were built by the occupying Egyptians? Or is it the hoax that the pyramid was much older than the Egyptians that lived in the area? What is the hoax exactly? I got into the show late.
Okay, Ray. The hoax basically centers around some painted marks that were allegedly found in some hidden chambers of the Great Pyramid in 1837 by a British colonel. And based on those marks, which basically they found the cartouche of a particular ancient Egyptian king, King Khufu, Egyptology ever since has declared the pyramid as the tomb of Khufu. And based on Khufu, they knew when Khufu lived. They've given the Great Pyramid the date of 2500 BC, based solely
Right. Isn't it pretty much, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but isn't it pretty much established that the pyramid, the Giza pyramid, is a much older structure built by...
Yeah, Ray, listen. Hey, Ray, not to be rude to you, you tuned in late. We've been covering this for an hour and a half. So, yeah, that's the point of this interview. So, I appreciate you listening, but... You're asking questions that he's already been over a couple of times. So for the benefit of everyone else who's been listening, I'm going to move on. I hope you call again. West of the Rockies, Todd in Morro Bay.
Hello.
Hi, Todd.
I was
Howdy.
Calling in reference to the emerald tablets that were found inside the pyramid, and they were translated by Sitchin. Hello?
So
yes.
What tablets were these, Todd?
The emerald tablets, they describe who built the pyramids, when, and why, and they said that they were built by the giants that came to the earth, the 200 giants, and basically the brothers would sleep in them to prolong their life.
Yeah. Well, I'm not, to be honest, Todd, I'm not entirely familiar with Zechariah Sitchin's broader work. I covered, obviously, his work with regards to these painted marks within the pyramid. That's purely what this book centers on, these painted marks, and how they have basically been used by Egyptology as the holy grail piece of evidence to prove that the Great Pyramid was built 4,500 years ago by Khufu. This book basically shows that's untrue. That's the beginning and the end of what this book does.
Thanks, Todd. Appreciate it. Yeah, you have to be careful, Scott, I guess, to keep it kind of focused, because you know you're going to take some hits.
Well, that I've already experienced that, George, but, you know, it goes with the territory. I'm very, very happy with the evidence that I have, the evidence that I've uncovered and presented in this book. You know, I build a case based on evidence, and that evidence tells me pretty conclusively in my mind that these marks are absolute fakes. Now, if Egyptologists out there listening to this show, if they think they are genuine, then listen, you know, get the evidence. Give us the evidence to show that these marks are genuine. That's all I'm saying. I'm presenting my case. Let's see your case, and let's have a better case than a British colonel of dubious character said they're genuine. We need something better than that.
Is there a connection? I mean, what is the connection between the Great Pyramid and all the other dozens of pyramids? Are they, I mean, did they build those other ones as a way toward getting to this one? And aren't the other ones tombs?
Right. Well, the later smaller pyramids may well have been built as tombs, but my focus, George, is mainly on the first 16 pyramids that the ancient Egyptians built, because to my mind, the ancient Egyptians tell us in their pyramid texts that the body of Osiris, who is the ancient Egyptian god of rebirth, was cut into 16 pieces. And the pyramid texts also tell us that the pyramid is Osiris. So if you look at the first 16 pyramids, these are the body parts of Osiris cut into 16 pieces. That's what it means. And if you actually map those first 16 pyramids, you know, use Google Maps, you plot it, all the locations of these first 16 pyramids, it makes a rudimentary outline stick man image of the classic Osiris figure with the three-pronged Atif crown and the crook and flail, you know, the crossed arms with the crook and flail. You know, so this to me is what the first 16 pyramids that the ancient Egyptians built as some kind of a disaster recovery system, not unlike our own civilization, George, has built Svalbard Global Seed Vault. They were doing the very same thing. And you know the strange thing is, George, when you look at what they found in the pyramids, the first pyramid, giant pyramid they built at Saqqara, you know, the original explorers of that pyramid in the early 20th century were walking up to their knees through grain in these long corridors and passages underneath that pyramid. They opened galleries underneath that pyramid with something like 40,000 vessels in underneath that pyramid. You know, all this different seed types underneath that pyramid and tools. These are the very things that, you know, a civilization anticipating, you know, it's going to be hit by a massive flood or destroyed would be putting in these vaults and building the pyramids as big markers or cairns. Here's where it is, you know, here's where to come to rebuild the kingdom. So that's my own personal theory. I'm not saying it's correct. But there's a lot of more evidence to support what I am saying than what the conventional narrative is saying.
Okay, let's go east of the Rockies. Our friend Barry in South Carolina. Hey, Barry.
Hey, George. I'll tell you what, buddy. Great show tonight. I've got a specific question for Scott, but the first half of the show, talking about Camp Girardeau, Missouri. I was born in 42, and believe it or not, I heard about it when I was about 10 years old in 52 or 53, and I was convinced ever since then, George, that we kept it secret because we were using retrograding to find out from those ancient aliens that crashed about atomic fusion, and that's where the atomic bomb came from.
Well, I think that our first guest explored that possibility that some of that technology was incorporated into our program. Paul Blake Smith had said that in his book. But if you got a question for Scott?
Yeah, but right quickly, could I please give you a little bit of constructive criticism without hurting your feelings?
I suppose
fire
it's inevitable.
Fight away.
Please, for George, please get back to some rock and roll. This doggone bumper music tonight is making me violently ill.
Okay. All right. Have you got a question for Scott?
I do. Why can't they go into the Great Pyramid of Giza, drill some holes into the rocks, the stone that makes up those pyramids, and do some accurate radiocarbon dating, and come, let's get the facts out. I know those things are 12,500 years old. Why won't they just tell us?
Well, I think, to be honest, Barry, they probably do know a lot, and they just aren't releasing the information. One of the things I find is that the carbon dating analysis that they've done back in the 1980s and 90s, you know, they found all these dates, but they only dated, you know, using carbon material from outside the pyramid, which could have been blown onto the pyramid, you know, by some winds. It's very windy around there, you know, so, you know, they need to get carbon from deep inside the pyramid, not outside the pyramid, you know. So this is the fundamental flaw, in my opinion, of those early original radiocarbon dating tests that were done. But yeah, you know, I totally agree with you, Barry. You know, let's get in there, let's get science in there, and and done in a truly wholly transparent fashion that we can see it's being done properly and openly, and let's get the facts, let's get the truth out there to people.
Thanks, Barry. Appreciate the call and the constructive criticism. We'll see what I can do. We're going to go to the first time caller, Bo in Houston, Texas. Hi, Bo. You're on the program. Hello?
Hello, how are you?
Hey, how's it going? You're on with Scott Creighton.
Oh, Scott, hi, how are you? I had a question about the Sphinx. I know you're into the pyramid. But I had a question about the Sphinx, because I know there's been, and I guess Graham Hancock got into it about, you know, it's over 10,000 years old. It was ancient, even to the Egyptians. One of the reasons why they built there was because they dug it out of sand. It was a lion's head. and it was facing Leo rising, which hasn't happened since the Ice Age in over 11,000 years ago. And I just thought that was very extremely interesting. I'd love to hear about your part of that.
I think that's, you know, amazing research. I think Graham did that with Robert Bovall. I think the research by Dr. Robert Salk, the Boston University geologist, is quite incredible as well, because it shows that you know, he's done an analysis of the weathering on the body of the Sphinx as well as the Sphinx enclosure. And he's found that, you know, the date's at least 7,000 years. That's at least 7,000 years. And that's just, you know, but, you know, Bo, there are other geologists, and this is one of the things I find really frustrating, is scientists can't agree among themselves. You know, you put, you know, three geologists in the enclosure at Giza, the Sphinx enclosure, and they'll all come up with three different answers. There's a couple of Russian geologists who basically said, well, no, the weathering on the Sphinx has actually been caused by waves, sea waves. And when you consider that, they're now saying that, well, actually the Sphinx is 800,000 years old, because that's the last time there was a sea, you know, encroached that far into Egypt, you know. So, this is what I said, you know, I just find it so frustrating that, you know, scientists can't really agree among themselves, you know, what the best way of dating these structures is.
Bo, appreciate the call. Thank you. Are there representatives of the Weiss family are still around, and how do they react to this criticism?
I'm not sure. I think there probably are some family members of the Weiss family. But at the end of the day, George, I'm merely digging out facts and presenting facts. And, you know, if the Weiss family, you know, if they read those facts and disagree with it, well, maybe they can put something together to show how my facts are wrong.
You had mentioned that sort of one basis of your theory was that the ancient Egyptians, or whoever these people were who built these pyramids, that they were preparing for a flood. Is there a paper trail for that? Do you have, is that written down somewhere, or is that passed on in sort of oral tradition?
Yeah, well, it's that particular story or legend comes from the Arabic chronicles, who basically wrote down some ancient Egyptian legends and kept them safe. It talks about King Saurid. In ancient times, he saw the sky had changed. The stars in the heavens had moved off their normal course, and he asked his astronomer priest, what does this mean? And the astronomer priest said, well, it means in 300 years' time there will be a great flood which will destroy the entire kingdom. And Saurid said, well, what we're going to do then is build giant pyramids, and in these pyramids we are going to place everything that we need to reconstitute the kingdom after this flood passes, so that the kingdom can be reborn again. You know, and that's where all this whole idea about the pyramids being about rebirth, you know, Egyptologists have picked that up. But they've picked it up because latterly, you know, once these pyramids built as recovery vaults or arcs, if you like, served their purpose, you know, later dynasties of ancient Egyptians would repurpose these pyramids as their tombs, you know. So I'm not saying the pyramids were never used as tombs. They probably were, because they've been around an awful long time, a lot longer than 4,500 years. And, you know, Cadillacs have been used for burial. You know, people do this kind of stuff all the time. You know, so it wouldn't be surprising that the pyramids were used as tombs, but that is not what they were built for.
Try to get one more call in. Sure. East of the Rockies, Jim in Virginia. Good morning, Jim.
Yes, sir. I'm curious to know if Scott is religious in any way, and if he thinks maybe the colonel was predisposed to try to prove the pyramids were the age of creation, that they were only 4,000 years old, and what inspired him to study and kind of debunk the colonel's position.
So, Sorry, Jim, I only caught a bit of your
His question was about whether or not you were inspired, you were sort of got started down this road based on your own personal religious views, whether you have any religious views that would be contrary to what the colonel believed.
Ah, right, I see. No, I have no religious views whatsoever. Let me just say, I'm not totally an atheist. I probably believe there is something out there that is intangible to us, that's deeper than us, but I don't know who it is, what it is. I just know that, or feel it, that there's something there. Is that what we call God? I don't know. I don't follow any man-made religion whatsoever. But I feel that there, you know, personally, that there is something deeper to humanity than you know, blood and flesh, you know.
Jim, thanks for the call. I get, after reading the book, it's very focused. It's very focused on the colonel and what he claimed, and then the trail of evidence that casts considerable doubt on the original claims that he made. Scott, very interesting conversation with you. It's a great book, The Great Pyramid Hoax. I wonder if there is a forum? Is there a forum at which you could have a direct discussion with the people who are going to pound you over the head over this?
Well, I normally conduct discussions on AboveTopSecret.com. I have my own forum. There, if you go to the main page, the forum page, I'm down there beside the author Jim Mars. You'll see Scott Crichton there. So if anybody has any questions they'd like to ask, they can start a thread. You know, just post a topic in my forum there, and I'll be happy to come in and answer them.
In a professional sense, will the Egyptologists give you a fair hearing? Is there some kind of university that'll consider these things?
Well, no, that's a kind of difficult one, yeah. I think, George, because at the end of the day, you know, the Egyptologists, you know, they've got their careers and reputations to think of. You know, their careers and reputations are bound up in the tomb and the tomb only theory.
Understood. Yeah, understood. So, Scott Crichton, it was great to have you here. I hope you'll come back. And the Great Pyramid Hoax is a fun read, and it's you did some good work. Thank you.
Thank you, George. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks also to my earlier guest, Paul Blake Smith, and to my colleagues there at Coast to Coast, Nathan Staton, Donna Walker, Dan Galati, our webmaster tonight, Greg Bishop, and my producer, Chris Boros. George Norrie is back tomorrow. I'm back next Sunday. Hope you can join us then. Good night, everyone.